I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Ethics reform was a top priority for legislators this session, but did they live up to their promise? I'll talk with Dan Krasner, Executive Director of Integrity Florida, about ethics reform and the impact on Floridians. Also, Central Florida native Rachel Potter has sung in Broadway musicals, and now she's released her first crowd-funded country album. I'll talk to Rachel about her transition into country music and her journey as an independent musician. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined from WFSU by Dan Krasner. Dan is Executive Director of Integrity Florida, a nonpartisan watchdog institute to promote integrity and expose public corruption in Florida. Dan, thanks for joining me.
Oh, it's great to be with you.
Senate President Don Gates made corruption a top priority at the start of the legislative session. Do you think he lived up to his promise?
Absolutely. Senate President Gates, Speaker Weatherford, Governor Scott promised ethics reform, and they delivered. The bookends on our session this year were ethics reform, campaign finance reform, and election reform. The very first day of the legislative session in March, unanimously with bipartisan support, an ethics bill passed out of the Senate. The elections bill moved forward from the House. By the end of session, there was bipartisan support for campaign finance reform. You know, it's been more than 36 years since Floridians have seen meaningful, comprehensive ethics reform addressed by our state legislators. So finally, after all the reports and the reputation hits for our state has faced with political corruption scandals, we've seen a very responsive, impactful group of lawmakers get together in a bipartisan fashion, unanimously pass a comprehensive ethics bill out of the Senate and the House, sign into law by the governor. And that bill has more than a dozen highly impactful good government initiatives to begin the process of cleaning up government in it.
Would you be confident that people will now follow the letter of the law as far as that bill goes?
Well, here's what your listeners will begin to see. You know, WMFE listeners can go online by the end of this year and finally see financial disclosure reports from our county-level elected officials up to the state. You know, finally, after the voters put that in our Constitution in 1976, legislature put it into law in 77, we're finally going to be able to use those disclosures of our, you know, we'll know the private financial interests of our public officials. We'll be able to get that information, access to it online, and be able to ask questions and hold officials accountable. That was a key recommendation that Integrity Florida made in our research reports, and we're grateful to see the Senate and House and Governor adopt that policy. You know, 27 other states, according to the Center for Public Integrity, had already accomplished that goal, and now Florida joined them.
And so it took about 30 years to actually have some reform there. Why did it take so long?
Corruption in Florida finally hit a tipping point where it could not be ignored. You know, Forbes magazine was talking about political corruption as a problem in Florida, and that's a magazine speaking to job creators around the world, so it was sending the wrong signal to the marketplace. Became a threat to our pocketbooks and to business. We also, in our research at Integrity Florida, found from 2000 to 2010, Florida had more federal public corruption convictions than any other state. And then, thankfully, in the spring of 2012, a collaborative international effort came together at stateintegrity.org with research comparing Florida to the 49 other states by the, Global Integrity, the Center for Public Integrity, and Public Radio International, and drew attention to the fact that Florida had an overall C-minus grade for corruption risk and a failing grade for ethics enforcement. You know, all that data, all that research, Integrity Florida gathered and shared with policymakers, the media, built a coalition, a bipartisan, diverse coalition across Florida, really built a movement that said, you know, the time is now. The time is now for ethics reform. And our lawmakers committed to accomplishing that, and they delivered historic ethics reform. We should be proud of them. It's great to see bipartisanship come back to life in our country and begin here in Florida.
So, Dan, is your work here done now? Is there a need for Integrity Florida still?
Well, we hope lawmakers continue down this track and put us out of business and make Florida. You know, our vision is government in Florida. That's the most open, ethical, accountable, and responsive in the world, and we. Our state, thanks to our lawmakers, made tremendous gains in that direction, but there's always more work to be done. A couple other elements of the ethics bill. There's going to be much stronger fine enforcement. Believe it or not, officials, elected and appointed officials and government staff members who have received fines by the State Ethics Commission over the years just blew them off. They knew if they could wait it out 4 years, the fines would be written off. So over the years, our State Ethics Commission wrote off more than $1 million of money owed to the people of Florida from officials who violated the State Ethics Code. So the new law says we're going to collect that money for up to 20 years. We're going to garnish wages of officials that do not pay. But in terms of more work to be done, the legislature ought to add one more tool to that issue and allow the Ethics Commission to put liens on real and personal property. Now, let's make sure that money owed to the people of Florida is collected. But there were tremendous gains on that issue. On the issue of ethics complaints, it used to be that a citizen would have to file a written ethics complaint to Tallahassee to the Ethics Commission. It would have to be legally sufficient. If things are grossly misleading or incorrect, someone could have to pay the legal bills of the person they're filing against. So citizen ethics complaints have kind of dried up. People stopped really holding officials accountable. They didn't want to stick their neck out. So under the new law, Senate Bill 2, there's four new sources of complaints to the Ethics Commission: U.S. and state attorneys, Florida Department of Law Enforcement, and the governor's office. Integrity Florida is encouraging all of those agencies to create report corruption hotlines for the people of Florida to call in what they know, do so anonymously. Let's get more tips rolling in. Let's crack down on corruption at all levels of government.
Dan, how is that different now from previous methods of reporting complaints before this legislation passed?
Before, it took a citizen to sit down and file a legally sufficient complaint and send it to Tallahassee. So we've had in the past ethics laws, but we haven't had the ethics law enforcement officers on the beat to enforce them. It's like having speeding limits without having a highway patrol officer on the interstate or the highways to crack down on speeders. So the ethics law enforcement has gotten dramatically better under the new bill. That's where Florida scored a failing grade on State Integrity Investigations National Report Card. We should see a much higher grade next time. Lawmakers ought to go one further step, though. 30 other states have state ethics commissions that can initiate investigations on their own without a referral. And that's the final step Integrity Florida would recommend our lawmakers take to put ethics enforcement at the highest level for Florida to, compared to other states.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dan, let me ask you about campaign finance legislation, House Bill 569, that raised the contribution limits from $500 to $3,000 for statewide candidates and $1,000 for local candidates, but it also eliminated committees of continuing existence. Was there some give and take in this?
The Florida House reached out to Integrity Florida and our staff to come in and testify before the House Ethics and Elections Subcommittee back in January and asked us to do some research. And the goal was not to get money out of politics. Everyone acknowledged we have a broken system of campaign finance. The goal was, can we make it more transparent and accountable? And how would we go about doing that? So Integrity Florida testified. We presented recommendations. We actually called for the elimination of contribution limits altogether, combined with 24-hour disclosure to the public of money in politics, what's being raised, what's being spent, the elimination of the slush fund committees of continuous existence, and also just streamlining those independent committees, and also getting better information to the public with an enhanced statewide campaign finance database. And the legislation, House Bill 569, sponsored by Representative Rob Schenck and Senator Jack Latvala, largely accomplished those goals, or at least movement in that direction. Mm-hmm. With campaign finance, for candidates for statewide office was previously $500, and it's now raised to $3,000. For local office and legislators, it goes from $500 to $1,000. And really all that's doing is rolling back to the pre-1991 levels. Florida was at those levels for years. It's bringing Florida more in line with where the levels are at in most of the country, closer to the federal limits. Integrity Florida would like to see the limits go away because they're really limits on political speech. We shouldn't have to ask the government for permission to speak, or we shouldn't have to face artificial restrictions on how much we can say. This is about political speech. People spend more on chewing gum in this country than they do on political campaigns. We should want more people to get invested in candidates and causes and engaged in the process. That's what we need rather than less people being involved. So the limits are actually going to allow us to hear, "I approve this message," more often. Mm-hmm. Candidates are going to be able to raise and spend money directly and be more accountable for their message. They were forced to raise the big checks through the political parties and these special interest committees over the years because of the artificially low limits. We have a broken system of campaign finance because it's hard to follow the money, and the big checks are flowing through other vehicles. Mm-hmm. Your listeners ought to know that someone can write a check of $10 million or any amount to a political party anytime they want. They can write it to a special interest group anytime they want. And those are the groups that are dominating our politics today at all levels. They're the ones running the ads from Floridians for a Better Tomorrow, Tomorrow, Tomorrow. I mean, these nonsense-sounding apple pie groups. So the question is, do you want more of that, more of these unaccountable groups spending the money, or do you actually want candidates to raise and spend their own money? And do you actually want to know who's giving them money? And that's what you get rid of the limits, or you at least raise them high enough. We'll actually know who's actually funding our candidates on our ballot. I think that's what we want.
I'm not sure that it would be so simple to say if you take away limits altogether, that's going to mean everything's going to be out in the open.
We ought to honor people's right to speak, and in this country you are allowed to have political speech even anonymously. It's not ideal in politics, but if you lift the limit, a candidate can raise a large check, and if there's a funny-sounding company or organization on the donor list, they're going to have to answer for it and explain it. Under the new laws, they'll have to do so even sooner because there's much more rapid reporting to the people of Florida. So, money's always going to be an issue in politics, but I don't see that as a bad thing. I see it as people wanting to express their free speech and be engaged.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. I'm talking to Dan Krasner, Executive Director of Integrity Florida. I'm Matthew Petty. You can join the conversation online on Facebook and Twitter or by emailing us at intersection@wmfe.org. Part of this bill requires lawmakers to attend an ethics course. Is this a good idea, do you think? I mean, what are they learning in this course?
Yeah, so there'll be a four-hour ethics training requirement as part of the new bill, and this applies to local officials up to the state. The Florida Commission on Ethics is going to set the curriculum, and I sure hope that all of our universities, maybe the University of Central Florida and others, will develop ethics training programs and make sure that the thousands of officials required to take the new ethics training will have different ways to take it. Hopefully there'll be webinars and mobile apps and interesting ways to reach people, because I think we have mainly good people that go into government or that run for office. But it's important for everybody to know what the laws are, know where the boundaries are on ethics policies. So, the ethics training is a really important component, and that's been proven in places like Palm Beach County to be highly impactful. Palm Beach County was known as Corruption County by Time Magazine, and they turned things around, and a big part of it was ethics training. They changed the culture. They put in place stronger ethics enforcement. Orange County has done similar great work there with Mayor Jacobs and others, finding loopholes in state ethics laws and adding to more financial disclosure and stronger voting conflict provisions. So, Florida's really turning around when it comes to good government reforms at all levels. Mm-hmm. This has been, for ethics reform, a ground-up movement with people like Carla Miller in Jacksonville and Matt Carlucci, the governor's appointee to the Ethics Commission that worked on a strong local ethics code for Jacksonville, Mayor Jacobs and others in Orlando. Down in Palm Beach County, our board member, Marty Rogel, and a big coalition came together and passed ethics reform. We've hit a tipping point. People want to see government cleaned up. Mm-hmm. And it's not a partisan issue. Corruption does not wear a party label. There was a tremendous coalition involved in that deserves the credit for passing ethics reform along with our lawmakers and governor.
Well, let's talk in a little more detail about Orange County. It's been about 7 months since the so-called TechGate scandal within the Orange County Board of Commissioners, and it was found after cell phone records were released that some commissioners were communicating with lobbyists the day of a sick time ballot vote. Mayor Jacobs called for a more transparent administration after that, and yet according to some reports, commissioners are still using personal devices for county communication. should she be doing more to promote transparency?
Yeah, transparency is important, but we have to make sure the policies don't get to a point where nobody wants to serve in government. Nobody wants to petition their government as a lobbyist or an interested party. Nobody wants to communicate with their officials. I mean, we have some of the best sunshine laws in the country here in Florida that apply at the local government level. You know, records are available. You know, if a government official or elected official communicates on a mobile device, whether it's personal or professional or their home email or their work email, that's subject to public record. You know, the public has a right to inspect those records, see those records. So, and technology is always changing. So you want to make sure you don't look at policies that get so restrictive that you know they're not evergreen and able to evolve as new technologies are introduced. You know, in Orange County, lobbyists have a job to do. There are lobbyists for charities and nonprofits. There are lobbyists for companies and associations. You know, those folks are advocates. We have a right to petition our government. They're doing what they're supposed to do. You know, officials should be allowed to communicate with lobbyists, with citizens, with whoever wants to have a voice in how their government is run. And of course, everything should be done in a transparent way. And I think we have good laws on the books to capture text messages and emails and voicemails and you know any record out there. It should be accessible to the public. Our vision would be that every government at all levels would put every penny of spending online for the public to see. Mm-hmm. So open budgets. Let's put every vendor contract online for the public to see. So open contracts. Every government database, let's have online for the public to see. You know, open data. You know, if we can accomplish open budgets, open contracts, open data, you know, that would be a tremendous step forward for Florida, put us on the global map for transparency.
Well, those are pretty lofty goals, but how likely is it, do you think, that that will happen in Florida?
Well, there were bills filed this year on open data by Senator Jeff Brandis and Representative Jamie Grant. They began moving in the process. Our officials are beginning to think about, you know, how do we accomplish open data in Florida? The state of New York did it this year. They created a whole new open data portal to share all government databases with their citizens. CFO Jeff Atwater has been a tremendous champion of putting government spending and vendor contracts online at myfloridacfo.com, his Transparency Florida website, and his FACTS website, the Florida Accountability Contract Tracking System. So we're moving there. Florida still has, at the state level, 9 different websites that track the budget. A bill that was passed this year is going to merge them into one. That was Senator Jeremy Ring and Senate President Don Gates had Integrity Florida testify on that issue, and we were honored to be able to contribute to the thinking of how do we make the state budget more accessible to the people of Florida. They made some great gains this year on legislation. I think we're about a year out from seeing that merged website and enhanced website, but we're getting there.
I've been speaking to Dan Krasner, the Executive Director of Integrity Florida, a nonpartisan watchdog institute dedicated to promoting integrity and exposing public corruption in Florida. Dan, thank you very much for speaking to us.
Thank you.
Up next, a conversation with country musician Rachel Potter. I'm joined in the studio by country music singer Rachel Potter. Rachel was raised in Seminole, Florida, and graduated from the University of Central Florida. She was in Broadway musicals such as Wicked, The Addams Family, and Evita, and her new single, The Verdict, is nominated for an Independent Music Award. She's currently touring to promote her new album, Live the Dream. Rachel, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, tell me about Live the Dream. What's the significance of the title there?
Well, I think it's pretty representational of what I've, you know, been going through, and it's become sort of an anthem for myself and also for musical theater performers alike, kind of everywhere. It's kind of the story of wanting to make it on Broadway and pounding the pavement, but it also represents that struggle that can be for anything, any dream that you have. So for me, it was very personal. I didn't write the song, actually. It's the only song that I didn't write on all of my records. Mm-hmm. But a friend of mine who produced my first record, his name's Justin York, and he wrote that song. And when I heard it, I said, well, I obviously have to record that because it's my story. Mm-hmm. It's been a really cool thing to see people kind of say, that's my story, that's me, you know, mm-hmm. That always feels great.
is country music the style of music that you really want to make your own for now, or do you see yourself going back to Broadway performances?
Well, I would never close a door on Broadway. You know, Broadway was my first big break and a really, really special time in my life. But I've always wanted to do country music from the time I was a little kid. I was designing my album covers when I was 7 and 8 years old, when other kids were playing with Barbies, you know. So country music has always been a passion of mine. I've always loved the storytelling and all of the instrumentation. It's just always kind of hit really close to my heart. I used to watch CMT all day in my room on my little 13-inch Emerson television and just dream about making my own music videos. But then I got a little sidetracked when I was in college and needed a job, and I started working for Disney World here in Orlando. And my first job was Ariel, the Little Mermaid. So that's when it ignited my passion for musical theater, and off we went.
Do you feel like there's more room for crossover now between different styles and genres of music than there might have been, say, 10, 20 years ago?
I'd say so. I mean, especially for Broadway versus recording arts, there's so many people that that come in from the recording arts to bring in sales for Broadway shows. You know, because these days people are so invested in people that are on television and whatnot. So it really helps Broadway sales to have, you know, a quote unquote celebrity to come in and bring their fans as well to the show. So it's kind of a great opportunity to like you said, sort of cross over and do different things. And a couple predecessors actually for Broadway, Laura Bell Bundy had a big Broadway career, and she crossed over into country music. And then Kristen Chenoweth, who had a, you know, enormous Broadway career, then went on to be on Glee and then went on to release a country album. And she's now touring a country album. So, yeah, I think that there's the door's kind of wide open, which is really encouraging.
Do you find that you're getting fans from who might have listened to other things like rock or, I don't know, hip hop or, you know, even Broadway music sort of coming over to country because of people like yourself?
I'd say yes. I think that the majority of the beginnings of my fan base weren't necessarily country music fans at all. They were Broadway fans, and they, you know, they had my time as Wednesday Addams in the Addams Family. That was really when I started to develop a fan base, which was amazing. It's incredible to see your fan base grow just from doing, you know, one show every night. You do 8 shows a week, and you talk to a couple fans here and there outside the stage door that, you know, you're literally gaining a fan a day. Mm-hmm. And it's not like a blowing up of, you know, you're on television one night and then 100,000 people love you. It's this very slow growth, but it was amazing to watch it happen and so encouraging. And then at the end of my time in the Addams Family is when I started a Kickstarter campaign to raise money for my record, and the response was overwhelming. I set a goal for $10,000, and by the end of it raised $20,000. And I mean, you can't ask for more loyal fans in the Broadway community. It's really cool.
I mean, that doesn't sound like a huge amount of money to make an album, whereas I'm sure it must have been more expensive pre, you know, iTunes and you know, the kind of era of do-it-yourself music we're in now.
Sure. And I think it still can be very expensive. Like if a record label is to produce an album and use like a huge name producer or something like that. But, you know, now with all the technology, people have studios in their homes that sound just as good as most of the studios that are, you know, pumping out professional records. So the independent music world right now is just kind of at its height because people have such an opportunity to compete, finally.
Now, you were raised in Seminole, relatively close to Tampa.
That's right.
Here in Central Florida. Do you see this as being a hotbed of country music? Is this a good place for country?
Well, I think that country is very much still alive. It's funny, when I'm in Nashville and people say, well, so you're a country singer, where are you from? I say Florida. They're like, that's not the South. But it is. You know, I think that there's a huge country music fan base in Florida, especially North Florida. But where I grew up, I mean, we always had country radio on. Always. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people... Florida is the southernmost state, so how can it not be the South? Come on. And there's plenty of horses and plenty of people that love home-cooked meals. I mean,
right.
What more do you need?
Right. Do you find there's any difference between the world of being in Broadway musicals and the world of country music? I mean, you said before that the fans in country are very loyal, and obviously you get loyal fans in Broadway too, but what about the industry around that? Is it supportive in Broadway and in country for young artists?
Well, I think it's quite different because in Broadway, there's a pretty black and white model as to how you sort of get there. Where, you know, if you want to be in Wicked on Broadway, you audition. And if you get the job, you get it. And if you don't, you don't. But with trying to attain a record deal, you know, there's sort of this gray, hazy competition where you really don't know how to get there. And, you know, I'm an independent artist, so I'm just sort of grasping at straws and doing the best that I can and hoping that if I make great music, someone will notice. And so, yeah, there's just not this definite path that you can walk down, mm-hmm. Which is both exciting and scary at the same time, I guess. But that would be where I would say there's a vast difference in the industries, and also age is a factor. Now, I'm 28 years old. I'm not 16 and straight out of high school or something with my guitar and 1,000 songs written. I'm a seasoned Broadway performer who's decided to shift into country music. So of course my competition is going to be high because mm-hmm. I'm competing with people that are much younger than me. And look much younger than me. And, you know, that people may think that they can sell more records because they're the next Taylor Swift or whatnot. And so that makes it a little more difficult. But I'm up for the challenge.
So who are your influences in country music?
Well, I grew up listening to the Dixie Chicks and Faith Hill and Martina McBride. I loved Tim McGraw, Rascal Flatts. Once they came out, I was like in middle school or high school when they came out. And then now, of course, I love Carrie Underwood and Taylor Swift. I also grew up listening to Alison Krauss and Union Station. And I think that that's something that has always really ignited my passion for country music was that bluegrass sound. Mm-hmm. And I loved Dolly, too, growing up. And I love the sound of a fiddle and a banjo. There's mm-hmm. just something that makes me so happy about that. And that's the kind of music I want to make. But I also want to write lyrics that influence me the way that some of my other influences that are outside of country music did, like Fiona Apple, who's so lyrically, you know, poetic and incredible. And I love John Mayer. And now somebody I'll never turn off is Sarah Bareilles. So that singer-songwriter, like deep lyrics, I love that. I love sort of gaining therapy and inspiration through lyrics. So my goal is to write music that does both.
So you've got quite a diverse spread of influences, but do you feel like when you say you're a country artist, people are going to say, well, they might pigeonhole you and say, well, you're going to have these kinds of views or your music's going to be this kind of way?
Sure. And I think that my viewpoint is going to be vastly different. I've lived in New York City for 5 years. You know, I worked for Disney for the 5 years before that. So my standpoint is extremely liberal as a human. So I'm not going to be a typical country singer. I'm a big supporter of the LGBT community, which I think may cause, you know, some rifts in the world of country. But I'm not afraid of that because I think that that's where the world is headed.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be a few people who disagree with me along the way. They're in the country fan base. But ultimately, I feel like in 20 years, we'll all look back on this and laugh.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, yeah, I think that I'm definitely different. I'm a different kind of country artist. I'm coming from, you know, Florida, not the middle
sure.
of Tennessee. I'm coming from New York on Broadway. So my life path has been very different. I didn't grow up riding horses, but I did grow up eating watermelon in Pineapple, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I have plenty of roots in the South. My mom and dad actually met in a country rock and roll band in Alabama. My whole family is like a Roll Tide family. So there's definitely like that Southern root in me, but also this completely liberal cosmopolitan side.
I've been speaking with country musician Rachel Potter. She has a new album out called Live the Dream. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast and listen to Rachel Potter talk about her song The Verdict, which is nominated for an Independent Music Award. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening. Both feet on the ground.